ladies and gentlemen, the appointed hour for this committee has come and gone, and we're going to go ahead and start. I am calling to order a joint committee on ways and means for the purpose of continuing some informational briefings. This is a combination of the Human Services and Transportation Economic Development Subcommittee. And we are here first to hear the state economic situation and forecast. And to that end, have two distinguished economists with us. And if you would introduce yourselves, and we will commence your presentation.
Good afternoon. My name is Dave Back, acting state economist from the Office of Economic Analysis. Here with me, Michael Kennedy, our senior economist. We appreciate our opportunity to present to you an overview of Oregon's economic and revenue outlook. We are going to review a December forecast first, and then look at what has happened since then. In particular, we're going to look at employment situation in the fourth quarter, and then investigate what the leading economic indicators tell us. Two of the biggest uncertainties surrounding our economy are housing sector and inflation pressures. So we're going to take a closer look at these two uncertainties. Having covered these two downside risks, we're going to talk about what's going to happen if these economic headwinds prevail. That is, many would agree that if I say we can reasonably deal very well with improving conditions, the question is, what happens if things get worse from here on? So we feel compelled to tell you that we have specific pessimistic scenario. Of course, flip side of the optimistic scenario, which we don't have to really worry about. A brief review of December forecast. We are calling for a slow growth in 2007 and inching toward trend growth from 2008 and on. If you look at personal income growth, you see a subpar performance during the recession between 2001 and 2003. And since 2004, we had reasonably good personal income growth. And this slide shows our December forecast. Our baseline scenario is after strong growth in 2006, we're going to have a slow growth, 1.2% growth in employment, before recovering to trend growth of 1.6 and 1.7% growth in 2008 and 2009. And we have pessimistic scenario where we say the economy may lose some jobs overall, but the substantial slowdown will occur in the first half of the economy before recovering in the second half of 2007. Now, what has happened since we put out our December forecast? What we see these days is something very consistent with our outlook on the economy. We see a deceleration in total non-farm employment growth. So it is 0.3% growth instead of negative. I mean, it looks deceiving. So let me make it clear. It's 0.3% growth, positive growth.
May I interrupt you for just a second? Perhaps for some of the committee it would be useful to have some definitions. When you say non-farm employment, help us with the definitional framework.
Yes. It's hard to count the number of employees in agriculture sector. So what we focus on is non-farm establishment, businesses. So we, our employment department people send out surveys. They collect information. So it's not an agricultural sector's employment, which we don't have good information about, and it's only the establishment in non-farm sector employment.
Thank you.
Thank you. Again, we registered 0.3 positive percent growth in fourth quarter, and that's a substantial slowdown from 5.8% growth in the first quarter. In December, we saw a small decline in jobs. Overall, in the fourth quarter, our construction employment is still strong. We're not seeing much downside impact from slowing housing sector. The reason is some of the losses in residential housing sector is being compensated by non-residential sectors, office projects, industrial sectors, and we have growth projects. Now, the job loss occurred in usual suspects in manufacturing, and retail and wholesale trade, which is consistent with consumer cutting back on spending. Now, we see job gains in leisure and hospitality, financial services, and healthcare services, and these are the sectors that didn't see a recession. Now, if you look at initial unemployment benefit claims, these are running a little bit higher than last year, and that's our concern. But at the same time, we're looking at many more jobs at this point than last year. So a little bit of increase in initial unemployment benefit claims certainly is a concern, but it's rather consistent with higher employment level at this point. Now, if you look at personal income and wages and salaries growth, they're really robust at this point, and then income tax holdings are in line with our forecast. Without looking into the details, without delving into the details of our leading indicators, basically what these indicators are telling us is we have slower growth ahead. And two of the biggest drags in the components of our leading indicators is housing permits. There's a substantial slowdown, a substantial decline in housing permits, and that leads to a decline in housing starts. And then some more people are claiming, are filing for unemployment benefits. Some of the positive come from financial sectors. If you look at the stock market, you don't see a slowdown coming. And the Federal Reserve System is trying hard to keep the economy afloat by injecting a little more money as needed. And if you look at oil and leading indicator, it tells us the same thing. We have a small decline, which is consistent with a deceleration in job growth. This tells you the movement of oil and index of leading indicators. The solid line is the indicator, and it's slightly negative. And it is consistent with a slowdown in our job growth. So in the beginning, I mentioned a couple of biggest uncertainties surrounding our economy. One is housing sector, and the other one is inflation pressure. So let's talk about housing starts. Well, we see shrinking housing permits, and that leads to lower housing starts. So residential construction side is being negatively impacted by this. The entire country's housing sector is going through a correction. In 2005 and 2006, we had overbuilding. There's no question about that. Now, if you look at Oregon, year-to-date through November, housing permits are down over 13%. And that later leads to a decline in housing starts by about the same amount. One positive that came out of recent data is that the declining rate of housing permits is declining. So the indication is that we are getting closer to the bottom of residential housing correction. And that's consistent with what's happening in the nation. And I'm sure you saw a report on housing starts this morning. It's up, and home sales are up. If you look at the sentiments of builders, it's improving. The first act of housing correction is there already. Now, what's the second act of this housing slowdown? Well, we're going to see loss of jobs and income in housing-related industries. We're talking about manufacturing, supplying building materials. We're talking about transportation services. We're talking about retail. We're talking about financial services, mortgage brokers. Now, it's going to take a little while to work off excesses in the housing sector. On the consumer side, we have shrinking cash out finance and less activity in refinancing applications. Now, that will lead to slower consumer spending. Now, interesting thing is Oregon home sales are down, but median home prices keep rising. Now, the second biggest uncertainty is inflation pressure. Well, at this point, inflation pressure is moderating. We have a balance of inflationary pressures and countervailing forces. Of course, the global economy is strong, so the global economy is using up a lot of commodities, resources. That puts pressure on prices. And these days, we have accelerating labor cost. Some of the countervailing restraints in inflationary pressure is cautious Fed policies. The central banks in the world are moving very cautiously, sometimes raising interest rates to put less pressure on inflation. And one of the biggest countervailing forces in inflation pressure is U.S. economic slowdown. So there is much less demand from the U.S. side on all things, including commodities. When the price is high, you see suppliers responding to this higher price incentives. And, of course, there's global competition, and that's one of the reasons why we have stable prices at the retail level. If we can characterize the economy at this point as the Goldilocks economy, it's not too hot, it's not too cold. Now, we have to be very careful about saying that, yes, it's the economy is just chugging along, not too cold, not too hot. Depending on the storyteller, you know how the story ends. In 2000, a lot of economists were talking about this Goldilocks economy, and you know what happened in 2001. But we don't see that happening again this time around. Indications are housing market will hit bottom in 2007. And consumer spending growth is slowed by cooling housing market, but at the same time is being sustained by real income increases. Now, business investment is strong. If you look at manufacturing sector, our capacity utilization rate is very high, over 80%. So business are in a position to have to add capital stocks. They've used up enough labor. Dollar depreciation will boost exports, and that helps our manufacturing sector. Inflation pressure will subside, allowing the Fed to cut rates. Global Insight forecast, Global Insight is the national forecast provider for us. They're building in 3 rate cuts, and that's 75 basis points from 525 to 450 this year. So all in all, we have to expect that we're going to have below trend growth. The trend we're talking about at the national level, 3% GDP growth, product output growth. In our economy, we're talking about below 1.5, 1.6 employment growth. We're forecasting 1.2% growth for 2007. Again, we can reasonably deal with improving conditions, and we have to ask ourselves what's going to happen if downside risks become reality, and are we prepared for that? Let me close out a discussion on the economic side with a rather pessimistic scenario. Of course, if you just reverse this trends or comments, then you'll be talking about upside risk. They were concerned that there is a rising labor cost, but it's about time that we see some wage increases. Firms are enjoying huge profits. They're sitting on huge cash, and their cash flow is good, and that's why when demand picks up, the business firms will be ready to invest more on their capital equipment. Now, if we have deeper housing downturn, and that will lead to a further slowdown in the economy. By the way, what we're going through is mid-cycle correction. If not for substantial slowdown in housing sector, we would have had a huge inflationary pressure. So the slowdown in housing sector is a mixed blessing. We don't want to see negative impacts coming from it, but at the same time, that relieves some pressures off our economy in terms of inflation. Now, if somehow prices shoot up again, now it doesn't look like at this point, and we're talking about $50 per barrel at this point, but there is always a chance that OPEC cuts back on production, and there will be there can be soaring oil prices. There's always a risk, and if inflation flares up, the Fed has to increase interest rates to fight inflation, and that's going to cause a severe damage to the economy. Now, if the foreigners lose confidence in dollars, and dumping dollars will lead to a weak dollar, and import prices increase, and that's going to raise inflation rates. There's always a risk about geopolitical tension intensifying. And if all this happens, then consumer confidence suffers and consumer spending declines sharply. So then the economy nearly sinks into a recession. That story is built in our pessimistic scenario. So in 2007, we don't see job growth, rather we may lose some jobs before recovering in 2008 and 2009. Now, Michael Kennedy will talk about revenue situation, but the impact coming from economic side is one thing, but Michael Kennedy will also talk about some other risks unique to revenue situation. So I can stop and answer your questions, or we can answer together after. It's up to you.
Thank you, Mr. Mark. I think we'll entertain some questions now. Senator Carter.
So did Representative Hanna just dismiss himself as an investor and go out and say, I'm not putting any money there because Oregon has a pessimistic outlook in terms of its economic welfare?
Senator Carter and Chair Johnson, the reason I discussed a pessimistic scenario is that we're not abandoning our baseline scenario.
Okay.
We're sticking to a baseline scenario, and all the indications are that what we put out in December is backed up by current developments. So we're sticking to baseline scenario, but what I'm trying to say is yes, there is a little danger, and economists are placing some probabilities, although small, on a recession. So,
follow up, Senator Carter.
So with the loss of manufacturing jobs, help me understand this, please. You're the economist, not me, so I thought at first it would be kind of stupid to ask you, but I don't. With the loss of manufacturing jobs and more service jobs staying stable, then how is it that we can talk about our economy being strong when we have strong job growth even at 1.2% possibility?
Senator Carter and Chair Johnson, it is true that Oregon is losing manufacturing jobs at this point. We got back many of lost manufacturing jobs since 2003. Nation as a whole is losing manufacturing jobs. Does it mean that we're losing competitiveness in manufacturing? Quite to the contrary. Our manufacturing sector is very, very productive and very highly efficient. Now, the flip side of this increase in efficiency is that manufacturing sector needs less labor force.
Okay.
Now, it is true that manufacturing jobs are paying high wages, but at the same time, if we train our workforce well, then we can find areas where even in manufacturing, technology development is one area. Pure manufacturing is being shipped abroad. Can we reverse that trend? That's going to be hard because we have to compete against just cheap labor overseas.
Yeah.
I have to tell you, but at the same time, we're creating even in manufacturing sectors as a nation high-paying jobs. So then, it is imperative for us to educate our workforce so that we are ready for high-paying jobs.
Thank you.
Any other questions, Mr. Brock, before we move on to Mr. Kennedy? Representative Edwards.
Madam Chair, are workforce productivity gains in Oregon keeping pace with those of the rest of the country?
Representative Edwards and Chair Johnson, we don't have the state-specific productivity data, but we can reasonably gauge our productivity stance against the rest of the nation. It's the productivity that will determine wages. Now, our wages are below national average, and we don't see much improvement on that front. And that's an indication that we're just barely keeping up with the productivity growth in the nation, or perhaps lagging. We don't have clear data. We don't have state-specific data. Mm-hmm. And if we see a substantial improvement in average wage rate, then I can say, yes, we're making progress.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, follow-up question?
Follow-up, Representative Edwards.
Are the wage and salary increases you project going to outpace inflation?
Representative Baldwin and Chair Johnson, yes, at least our average wage growth rate outpaces inflation rate. Now, we can't be satisfied with that because in our forecast we have nominal wage, not real wage. Nominal wage is also considers inflation factors too. So we have to do very well to see a reflection of higher productivity in our wage.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
One last question, otherwise in the interest of time, we're going to move on to Mr. Kennedy. Thank you for your presentation. Mr. Kennedy?
Good afternoon. Chair Johnson, members of the subcommittee, for the record, I'm Michael Kennedy, senior economist with the Office of Economic Analysis. I'm going to spend a little bit of time here on the current biennial revenue forecast, only in the event that there are certain issues and assumption changes here that affect our forecast going forward. And then I'll spend more time on what's pertinent to this body, which is the revenue forecast for the next triennium. And then I'll talk about lottery for just a second. So the first table we have here shows the current forecast, which has been out for a month and a half now and is widely known. The numbers by source of forecast have issues with our pointer here. Currently $12.7 billion forecast or projected for this biennium. The second column is the first point I want to make out, and that's, it's widely known, but it bears repeating, the distribution we have across revenue sources. As you can see, 87% of our general fund revenue comes from a single source, personal income tax, and that's much higher than any other state has a reliance on a single source. Washington is basically second with about 60% reliance on sales tax. Add in corporate income tax here at 6%, we're 93% reliant on income tax, one of the more volatile forms of revenues relative to, say, sales tax or property tax. So it's just something that bears in mind, and obviously is an issue we deal with on an ongoing basis. Now, the second point I want to make here on this table, these are the growth rates in these revenues relative to the 0305 biennium. So you can see 23% growth in personal income tax. The 21% here is actually skewed down because we have $135 million in kicker credits going out this biennium. If you adjust for that, corporate income tax is actually at 42%. Overall, adjusted for the kicker, the corporate kicker, we're talking about 23% growth for general fund revenues for this biennium. That compares to a long-run average of about 12%. So obviously, this is an extraordinary biennium, and we're seeing some amazing growth, and it brings up basically an issue. Whatever is driving these extraordinary increases is of critical importance to our assumptions about future revenue growth. All right, basically, it comes down to temporary factors versus permanent factors. If it's more temporary factors, you expect then when those temporary factors go away, you'd have a correction and lower revenues than otherwise. If they're mainly permanent and these are permanent level shifts, then you would expect higher revenues going forward in the future. And one of the problems in basically gauging what these factors are the long data gaps you have between when you see the revenues coming in and when you basically get the tax returns that'll tell you, to some degree, what it is that we're driving those increases in collections. So those are the issues we're coping with now, struggling with now. Since the May 2005, or what we'll call the closed session 2005 forecast, basically we've made two major assumption changes as we've gone along, and they concern the nature of capital gains, again, personal income tax collections, and the nature of U.S. corporate profits in the U.S., which obviously tie to corporate income tax in Oregon. So first, I would say if there's one image to take away from at least the revenue side of this forecast, that would be this chart right here. This is the net taxable capital gains income, historical, for full-year resident Oregon filers. As you can see, you may have seen this chart before, but during the 90s, we had a significant run-up in taxable capital gains associated with high-tech stocks and telecom. And I bring that up because in 2000 there was a discussion going on that was basically after 4 years and say 3 years of 20% gains in the stock market, people were asking, okay, is it real or is it memorex? Is this a permanent level shift up to a new level? You know, basically you heard the term paradigm shift. You know, the telecom age, the computer age had really drastically increased productivity in America, and we could expect to see gains and returns on stocks and basically capital valuation on level with this for all time to come. Needless to say, a year later, we suffered a correction of that and a realization that if it seems too good to be true, it probably is. Well, recently, and in fact, we say recently, but in fact, we're still using a forecast for 2005 capital gains. That's opposed to that lag in tax returns. And so, but the inference we're gaining from what we're seeing in basically tax collections is that capital gains have increased dramatically in the last couple of years. In tax year 04, they increased 45% in 1 year. And the question there is much the same question as before. What's driving these, and to what degree are they temporary factors versus permanent? All along here in the last year and a half, we've discounted a considerable amount of this as due to temporary factors. There's no real evidence as to what this is, so you have to make some assumptions. But you looked out at the economy and said, what out there looks like a boom market that might tie or correlate to what we were seeing in the 90s? And you looked at housing bubbles and house price appreciation. You said, okay, if that's the case, then when that housing bubble goes away, you should see a correction in this similar to the 2001 stock market correction. Well, evidence, recent evidence, is that actually real estate has little to do with what's going on in capital gains. We get most of that evidence from California, who take a lot of effort to understand their capital gains because in 2000 they accounted for 25% of their total personal income tax. So they had a very good incentive to invest in research into this area. And what we're hearing from them is even there where you had very bubble markets, very high appreciation rates, San Diego, Silicon Valley, etc., that real estate was of little factor in their growth in the recent capital gains. So we took that into account and said, okay, if that's not the case, the offsetting sort of explanation is that a considerable amount of losses were generated in this stock market collapse here. And taxpayers are allowed to carry those losses forward and offset gains. So what it appears is really that these levels were abnormally low because they were offset by large losses. Well, when those losses go away, and you should see a jump back up to, say, real sustainable levels of capital gains. And that seems to be more what's going on. So in the recent forecast, we've really shifted more to basically buying into the permanent, and long-term sustainable capacity of the stock market and other asset markets to generate these gains. That's the point here, is if that doesn't sound familiar, it is the most likely explanation given the existing evidence, but it's just that familiarity, we were only 5-6 years ago, so that is just to keep that in mind in terms of a risk going forward, in terms of what the assumptions are underlying this revenue forecast.
Thank you. We'll pause for a question. Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kennedy, it brings up the question, I guess, as I compare the difference between what we saw in wage growth versus the difference in the growth of the personal income tax. And I guess I'm assuming that the 23.3% growth that you show in the graph. So if you had wage growth but slightly beat inflation, you've got some margin of difference there. And how much of that difference is this capital gains piece versus those who have LLC, subchapter S type income gains? Can you break that down?
Chair Johnson, Representative Hannah, yes. In fact, sort of the wage component of total taxable income in the state basically accounts for 6% growth on average per year, 6.5% growth. Throw in retirement income pensions, which is similar, it's basically deferred wages. Mm-hmm. You're basically looking at roughly 6-7%. Now, that 23% is a biennial increase, and you don't have that for the annual. So you're looking to make up basically 6 percentage points. This accounts for about half of basically that super normal growth. The other thing that's accounting for it is small business income for proprietorships, partnerships, and Schedule E income, which a subset of that is the LLCs and LLPs. So it's really capital gains and the small business income that are the true drivers for what we're calling supernormal growth or extraordinary growth.
Representative
Hannah. Thank you. And I appreciate you explaining that, because I think it's fairly critical to point out that sometimes we show that corporate tax as a percentage of our total tax collected is less than it is, when in fact small business corporations that are LLCs and or subchapter S and those folks who pay their tax through personal income tax account for a much larger part, and from what we've just heard from you, actually a much larger part even in the gain in personal income tax. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please continue, Mr. Kennedy.
The other assumption shift we've basically had concerns corporate income tax. And as you can see here, this is a very similar chart to the last. It shows U.S. corporate profits, of which Oregon then taxes an apportioned share of that down to the Oregon level. And again, similar to the capital gains, you've seen a dramatic increase in both the current gains and the future expected levels of corporate profits, and that is fed into the recent increases in our corporate income tax projections. Again, you see growth here. You can see the level here in basically the peak of the 90s, 97, at basically $800 billion. In just a few short years since the recession, we've jumped up to about $1.8 trillion. So a doubling of corporate profits, which is extraordinary. And again, similar question. What are the factors driving this? To what degree are they temporary versus permanent? And there's no perfect clear insight to that right now, but just, again, the expert advice, the evidence, just points to more permanence in this being a result of globalization, constrained costs and input costs, and as we know, firms are out there just sitting on massive cash balances, and this appears to just be a product of more of a permanent shift. But again, that's an assumption based on existing evidence, but has the potential to turn out to be not true, and if that were to be the case, you would see a considerable decline or correction in corporate profits and corporate income tax. So, but those two shifts basically underlie what increases we've made since the close of session forecast in the revenue forecast. This has been public for months and a half now, so I won't belabor it, but the current forecast for the biennium, $13 billion in resources, marginally changed from September, but obviously up almost $1.4 billion from the close of session due to these extraordinary factors. Now, how has the forecast been tracking since we published this? Well, in fact, its paid collections are tracking slightly below the forecast. In particular, estimated payments, the fourth quarterly estimated payment for 06 is below what we expected, and the refunds related to extended returns, extended 05 returns are slightly higher. And we were talking nominal tens of millions of dollars here, but really this is the first time in about a year and a half that we've seen collections tracking below forecast. So it may be a sign that the models in the forecast have assimilated these recent extraordinary increases, and it will level out now to tracking more closely. There's not a pure translation between whether we're tracking below for a couple months here or there and whether the next forecast will be up or down, because there's a lot of vagaries about shifts in payment patterns. So, but still, and corporate collections, let me talk about that for a second. Corporate collections continue to track above forecast. Payments are still roughly 20% up year over year, despite the fact that you have a 36% tax kicker credit on the 05 returns. So, but they're core collections are even more interesting in the timing patterns and the lags. So there's still a strong question here as to the validity for the real liability increases relative to the money that's pouring in. Do they really owe all this money, or are they going to turn around a year from now and all of a sudden refunds spike? And it happens. Corporate is a wild animal in that respect, so it's a downside risk. But when we look overall at all revenue tracking currently, there's no indication of any significant up or down changes to the forecast in the coming future. Moving on to the next biennium, or the forecast for the next biennium. We have the carryover of $1.4 billion ending balance. The structural revenues are roughly $14 billion. Now, from that, we are going to distribute roughly $1.1 billion in personal and $275 million in corporate. So our net tax revenues are going to be about $12.6 billion. But the total, as has been published, is roughly $14 billion in available resources for the 709 biennium. Now, risks to the forecasts. The first one is what we'll term a fiscal recession. And what that is if we were just to entertain a scenario in which capital gains were actually to drop or be significantly below our current forecast for reasons I've alluded to, and corporate income taxes were to have a correction, you can see revenues, general fund revenues, actually be down next biennium, as in decrease from this biennium, even if you look at the economy and saw employment still growing. And so I'm terming it the fiscal recession because it's purely with respect to those issues, and particularly in income that generates tax revenues here, it's not directly tied to those employment or economic characteristics we talk about, employment growth, income growth, because they're basically concentrated among a few firms and among a few wealthy individuals. Mm-hmm. Now, add to that all of the scenario, basically the pessimistic scenario, low probability weighted as it is, still if it were to come to fruition, you would compound these issues with that. And when we run, it's a worst case scenario. You can see relative to that $14 billion baseline projection for resources next biennium, something as low as $12.5 billion actually coming to fruition. So this is a downside risk of up to $1.5 billion. Now, to put that in context, the 2001 closing session forecast was about $11 billion in available resources, and the structural shortfall was $2.4 billion. So this potential right here still would only be about half as, say, painful as the 2001. It would be painful, but it wouldn't be as painful as five special sessions and $2.4 billion in lost revenue. I was asked to actually touch briefly on the 2009-11 biennium. This is our standard chart here showing biennium to biennium percentage changes in general fund revenues. In 2009-11, the actual change will have an increase of 23%, but that's only because of the kicker effects of the prior biennium. The structural revenue growth will be about 11%. I'm going to talk about lottery in a second, but if you add in $1.3 or $1.4 billion in lottery revenues to $15.5 billion in general fund revenues, you're looking at roughly a 13% increase in general fund resources for the biennium after next.
Sure. Senator George.
Explain that uptake on the kicker. How exactly does that yield money? If it goes back.
Chair Johnson and Senator George. If I term something the structural revenues, it was what would exist if the kicker didn't exist. Mm-hmm. So it's not what state of affairs we will be in, but we have basically have two forecasts. There's the structural revenue forecast, ignoring the kicker, and then you just take the kicker and lop out $1.4 billion, saying that's fine. So
can I clarify that question?
Follow-up, Senator.
Basically, the impact of the kicker going out on the future revenue. You build in a calculation what the net effect of that stimulus is or taxable income based on the payment of the kicker.
Chair Johnson, Senator George, most of the dynamic modeling has shown very little persistent and long-term impacts of temporary bump up in discretionary spending. Generally, you just see a lot more Xboxes.
The Chinese could be expected to prosper from that.
Please continue, Mr. Kennedy. Mm-hmm.
Very briefly, this chart has been shown before. In terms of video lottery sales growth, this chart shows the year-over-year sales growth. As you can see, as of May 2005, when line games were implemented, you see the rapid run-up in year-over-year growth in sales, culminating in the spring of 2006 with 34% year-over-year growth. So quite an impact. Now, as we get to where we're comparing line game sales to line game sales, we should see that growth rate fall back down to normal long-term trend levels. However, for the first half of this year, we actually saw a reversal and persistent 20% year-over-year growth, even though you're comparing line game sales to line game sales. Now, the major factors there are lottery continue to upgrade the machines. They continue to add new and state-of-the-art games that players like. So there is a reason for that, but still, at some point, this will come down to normal long-term trend growth of about 6%. And that seems to be occurring right as we're speaking. Real briefly, the forecast for this finding is about $1 billion. We've just broached $1 billion in resources for 507. The forecast for next finding is about $1.3 billion in available resources. And currently, as has not been the case in a very long time, the video lottery sales forecast is actually tracking almost identically with actual sales. So it appears that we finally assimilated the impact of line games into the forecast, and we should see less major departures in future forecasts, should. And that is what we have.
Thank you very much, Representative Bode.
I feel really out of it. I don't know what an Xbox is, but I've heard of it. And I don't know what a line game is, but I've heard of it. And I don't have a TV set at home, so am I missing something here? Thank you for your very good presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. There being no more questions, I will thank you for your very comprehensive presentation and invite Mr. Penn forward.
Thank you very much, members of the committee. My name is Dale Penn. I'm director of the Oregon Lottery. It's a pleasure to be here today. Madam Chair, how much time, when do you want me to be done?
On our published agenda, you will be done at 2:05, followed by Mr. Ball.
Okay.
But you started 5 minutes late, so we can cut into Mr. Ball.
Okay. My one comment about line games and Xboxes, I don't know what an Xbox is either. I didn't play line games before I became director of the lottery, and I can't play them now. But Powerball is $205 million. And we had three $200,000 winners last night, so you can pick up a quick $205 million. You can't win if you don't play the game. And it goes for good purposes, as you know.
Well, and are you advocating we adjourn the committee and we all run out and buy a Powerball ticket?
That may be a good idea. Well, I want to give you a brief overview of the lottery, and so I have a handout that hopefully all of you have received, and I'll go over this pretty quickly, but obviously if you have any questions, we're happy to deal with those. It starts off with the fact that gambling is one of those things that we can joke about, but that's a deep philosophical belief, and some people are just opposed to gambling, and that isn't part of where the lottery is coming from, to be an advocate for gambling or not. This is just simply a decision the voters of Oregon made 21 years ago, and so the lottery's attempt is to provide the games that the voters have requested. And so this establishes on this first page just that these were voter-approved constitutional changes that set up the Lottery Commission as a separate agency with oversight and spending authority and budgeting and authority over this lottery. And it has maintained strength. And the last little bullet there talks about that our current favorability rating is 63%. It is one of our performance measures I'll talk about later on, but that has stayed fairly stable.
Representative Cote.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question. How do you, what's public favorability? What's the question that that's based on?
Madam Chair and Representative Kotek, we do tracking studies really to judge popularity of games and that type of thing, but one of the questions we'll ask is, do you think the lottery is a good thing or a bad thing? And we force them in this question to either choose it's favorable, unfavorable, basically. But I think there's four choices there. But that's the way it has been set up. I couldn't cite off the top of my head the exact question, but we have professionals do that, and that's what it's designed to accomplish.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
If I move to the second page, just give you a quick overview of the organizational structure. There's five commissioners. These are appointed by the governor and must be confirmed by the Senate. We have four presently. We must have a CPA.
And the CPA is the chair of our audit subcommittee. We have to have a person with law enforcement experience. We have a retired sheriff from Oregon. We also have an executive vice president from Harry and David. We have a lawyer from Oregon, from Portland, who is our present chair, and we have one vacancy. The assistant director for security must be a law enforcement person with law enforcement background, but that is the way that we are set up. Our mission statement's on page 3, and it's that we operate a lottery with the highest standards of integrity and security to earn maximum profits for the people of Oregon commensurate with the public good. Security and integrity are very important, and they are at the front of that mission statement, but I also will state that public good, not only does it refer to the programs that are funded, education, parks, economic development, habitat, but also the manner in which it is done. And we believe that problem gambling and responsible gambling is part of that public good. Our budget planning process on page 4, we talk about basically each year, we have a yearly budget, and the commission will develop a strategic plan. They've just finished doing that. We are in the present stage of developing a business plan and project plans and financial plans for that. The budget is presented and signed in June, and as you can see, we return that budget to the governor and the legislative fiscal officer, legislative revenue officer. Page 5 is probably the most important one, and that is one that the forecasters just talked about, and it just speaks to the projected growth in transfers. And if you add 2006, which is closed on our books, but the projected level for 2007, you come up with that $1.026 billion transfer that Mr. Kinney just talked about. It is interesting to note that in 21 years, the beginning of the lottery, $4.6 billion has been transferred to the state for state programs. And yet you see now the tremendous growth that's occurred in the last 5 or 6 years, so that every 2 years, there will be over $1 billion added. So started very small and has increased dramatically over that 21-year period. The next page is just really how you as the legislature have distributed these proceeds. But perhaps there was a question?
Oh, I apologize. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you very much. I'd like to ask a question about the projected record growth. I'm not sure if this question is better directed toward you or the previous speaker, but can you tell me, please, the primary criteria used in forecasting increase in lottery sales or just in forecasting the sales generally? For example, how much do you use population growth, age and other demographic factors, national trends? What is it that leads you to these conclusions?
Madam Chair and Representative Nathanson, the previous speaker would be the best one to answer that, but I can tell you that they will track past sales. They will inquire of lottery staff, are there any management changes that we are making with particular games? So obviously when line games are brought online or new products or new games are brought out, that will be a factor. But I know that they also do a broad analysis of what are the economic conditions, not only in Oregon but nationally. And they're using some of the same analysis they would give you for personal income that factors in. But all the specifics, I couldn't give you any more than that.
Follow-up, Representative Nathanson, or was that responsive?
I would like to know more, but I don't want to take the committee's time at this point.
Thank you very much. I would suggest perhaps that you have the opportunity to speak with Mr. Kennedy, if that would be instructive.
Thank you.
Senator Bergen.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Have you always had the privilege of advertising in the lottery from the very beginning, or did I think that that was not true in the very beginning and that advertising lottery came on after the formation of the lottery?
Madam Chair and Senator Berger, I can't answer that precisely, other than that I know that advertising has been utilized by the lottery for many years. I couldn't answer if it was the very first year or not. it's my inclination that it was. And from time to time, that becomes an issue, and other states have looked at restricting advertising. It's been discussed in this chamber at times over the years. We are a sales organization, and advertising is one of those management tools that we can use to keep our sales up to be able to present the transfer that we do.
Senator Munro.
Yeah, wondering about, and it looks like you're going to go over this a little later, the percentage that the store owners keep their cut. That's later in your presentation. So I will,
yes, it is.
I'll save my question.
I'll try to move quickly.
Yeah. Thank you. Senator Morissette.
What loss will occur from the sports action? Continuing the sports action.
If we move to page 13, I tried to identify some risks, just as the forecasters have, and excuse me, Madam Chair and Senator Morissette. And so page 13 talks about that will be a bit of a hole that we will have, and I'll try to address that a little bit more.
Okay,
thank you. I'm an exercise partner of the chair, and I'll stay on the course of your presentation.
Okay. I'm on page 7. I just simply want to bring forward something, that the strength of the lottery as a bonding support. I know that I read in Oregonian today that you had a presentation at Ways and Means about the difficulty of the bond levels for the state, and yet the end of that article talks about a bright spot for Oregon is the lottery-backed bonds. And I just simply detail for you here the fact that in the last 2 months the bond rating for lottery backed bonds has increased and been upgraded, and that will give you the opportunity, if you decide to utilize lottery to support bonds this session, to reduce some of your insurance costs and reduce some of your interest costs. But I think that is a very stable source. Quickly mention page 8 that we are very interested in maintaining our reputation and the integrity of the lottery. Every year the Secretary of State does a financial audit. I've just been told that in 2006, as in previous years, there will be no material findings, no management letters. We have an outside security review, and you can see the description there that our security meets or exceeds the best practices for lotteries in the United States. As I mentioned, we have a commission audit committee, and we have a very aggressive internal audit program. The contingency reserve is another issue that raises questions sometimes in the legislature, and let me address that very quickly. And I've cited for you the statute that talks about the lottery must be a standalone agency. We cannot receive dollars from state government. We cannot receive bailouts or loans. And so we have to be able to pay our own freight. We have to be able to cover our expenses. The Lottery Commission established the reserve, contingency reserve, really to do that. And there's our building value and machine value is in this reserve, but those obviously aren't liquid assets. But we do maintain $45 million of cash as liquid assets in this reserve. $20 million of that is, in effect, our checkbook to be able to pay our bills and to keep things moving forward. $25 million then becomes our actual reserve. When you compare it to a $1.25 billion transfer, which is what we're doing in this session, that is a very small reserve. But that is how it's there and why we've done it. I quickly move to key performance measures. I talked about the bottom line measure for the lottery is how much money do we produce for the program for the state of Oregon. And so transfers, that's set by a forecast, but we've been able to beat that target. Our favorability, we try to track that. Our administrative expenses, we also obviously track that and try to keep those at a minimal level.
Madam Chair?
Question, Senator Gorbel.
Thank you very much. Mr. Penn, is there a performance measure tied to gambling treatment?
Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, we do track increases in, this will sound strange, but increases in hotline calls for treatment. And what our goal is DHS manages treatment. We have nothing to do with treatment. However, we do involve the director of their program in our marketing and in our sales work groups. But we advertise the 1-800 number. There would be no presentation of the 1-800 number for help and treatment without that program. And so what we do as a performance measure, we track when we run our ads or television about the 1-800 number, did calls increase? And we've been able to see that. And we've actually targeted our message to, in effect, underrepresented members of the public. And so at one time we shifted to women and we saw an increase in treatment or women calling in. So we do try to track that.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, may I just make a point on that?
Yes, please, Senator Carter and then Representative Tillman.
Just on that point, and I think that as a body, we really, really do need to be on top of this issue because too many times we have taken the money that was put into law, into statute, for us to give that to human services to be able to help people who got into problems with gambling addiction. And the Ways and Means Committee has been very guilty of taking some of that money away to use to do other budgetary means. And so it's something that I think that we need to be on top of in terms of our own level of consciousness about us as a state in the first place, you know, dealing with gambling issues. And no to Representative, to Senator Berger, we made a decision in 1985 not to do advertising of lottery as a marketing strategy. I guess some of us had a sense then, well, maybe we better keep a little swing in our game.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think what we're alluding to here is the cost of society, and I'm not sure that you're going to be able to track that. But it's not just gambling addiction, it's bankruptcies and divorces and neglected children, et cetera, all those kinds of costs that we know come along with gambling addiction. Is there any way that you can track that?
Madam Chair and Representative Tomei, no, that is not my expertise. However, Mr. Jeff Murata from Human Services would be able to give you a number. And I was in front of a legislative committee, and he gave a rather large number for that. And one thing to remember about that is that there are really a variety of different gambling mechanisms out there. There are casinos. There is the Internet. There is illegal gambling. There is the lottery. All four contribute to problem gambling. Only one makes an effort to treat that, to deal with it, to help people understand it. And so I think that's the strength of Oregon's approach to this. My last page does document for you a few things we've done. The fact that 1% is very important for treatment. It is the highest, really, and presented probably the best gambling treatment program in the United States, but it has to be supported. Let me quickly move, if I can, Madam Chair, to two other slides here and quit. Is the video commission rates on page 12 and then some of the challenges on page 13. Let me quickly say on page 12, commission rates is something 3 years ago, if we sat here right now, the commission rate was 32%. That was the amount that the owner of a restaurant would receive from sales from video machines. In 2004, that contract ran out. It was a new contract was done, and I'm going to use, these are complicated multi-tiered scales, but I'm going to use a number that if you blend it all together for your sales, what's the average? So the average ended up being 28.5 in 2004. When I came on board and line games were started and the request for an additional $120 million was made last biennium, we put a new product out there and we said, and you're going to have to reduce the commission rate. So it went to 25. At the same time, the commission said, you know, this is a projection, and we were thinking sales would go up 27%. As you've heard, they went up above 40%. And so the commission, back when we adopted this 25% rate, we said in June 2007, we're going to look at what the sales actually were. It's not going to be projections. What actually happened? And if sales go above $805 million, which is roughly a 40% sales increase, then commission rates will automatically drop down to around the 23% level. The December forecast says that our video in June 2007 will be $836 million. I fully believe that in this summer, in June 2007, the commission will have that information and will vote, and that we will move to 23. In 2010, the contract is extinguished, and we'd have another opportunity to review this again. But that's the status. The last thing I'll say, if you look at the printing there, I think we were able to accomplish two good things. We were able to reduce commission rates, but we were also able to keep a vibrant, healthy retailer network selling our product. And so what you see is that we not only were able to produce $120 million, we have been able to produce $200 million beyond that. And those of you in the special session last spring were able to dole out $42 million to schools. That was because of this increased sale. So we've been able to keep the product strong and yet keep whittling away at that percentage. I know I've gone over my time. We have a small loss with Scoreboard and Sports Action in our player base. Our traditional products have kind of flattened, and that's a challenge for us. And again, not to take positions on these things. I know the governor strongly supports a smoking ban. I need to put it up there, though, just to let you know. We are going to be challenged by this aggressive forecast, and smoking will have some impact. But I feel we can meet the $1.25 billion forecast that's there. Potential casinos from Vancouver, the center, and to the private Portland casino, those can have an impact into the future about the sale of lottery products. You will see Senate Bill 69, which may allow us to move from a warm site in the Burns location, which we would not have to pay about $250,000 a year in costs. That would be only with local public support if that comes forward. So I hope you will see that in the session.
Thank you, Mr. Penn. I'm going to entertain no questions. Remember, many of you will get another bite at the apple when this comes before the subcommittee. Thank you, Mr. Penn, for your presentation.
You.
And we'll now invite Mr. Ball forward to talk about the scenic. Good afternoon, Mr. Ball.
Chair Jones and members of the committee, my name is Lindsay Ball. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Administrative Services. To make sure that, Chair, that I understand my task today, you mentioned that you wanted me to give you an overview of scenic. I can do that. Give you some information on the consolidation and reorganization of the Information Resource Management Division.
I think I would prefer to stick with the published agenda item, and if there's time remaining at the end, if you could make a comment on scenic, that would be fine. I got a little ahead of myself.
That's fine. I have some of the information on scenic with the handout that you have. More detailed on the reorganization, however.
Thank you. I apologize for being a little behind schedule.
Nope, you're doing well. The purpose of my testimony today, members of the committee, is to provide you with an overview of my decision to reorganize the Department of Administrative Services Information Resource Management Division. And let me give you a couple of reasons why. When the Information Resource Management Division, which was the central IT oversight entity in the state government, when it was created, in the late 80s, early 90s, and I can't give you a specific year because no one can remember for certain, but it was built on a business model and a financial model of the late 80s, early 90s that didn't work for us today in 2007. And basically what it amounted to was the agencies at that time did not have the technically skilled staff that they have today. We have a very robust staff in state government with strong technical skills in IT management today compared to what we had when IRMB was created. Also at that time, in the late 80s, early 90s, we did not have all the commercially available computer programs as we have today that we can buy, reach over and pull off a shelf and go up to the counter and buy them. We were writing specific programs in state government for state government. Today, we can go buy them. And we don't have to have a cadre of staff writing programs is what we once did. In addition to that, we also looked at how we were managing IT projects in the state. And we were charging agencies almost $100 an hour for staff from the Department of Administrative Services, IRMD, to manage projects in the agencies. And they can, number one, have it hired, done privately for a lesser amount. And in addition to that, we had also trained state agencies to be project managers. And we had invested in the agencies, and so my thought was if we can go to the private base, do it cheaper, and albeit let the agencies do it themselves, which is even cheaper than contracting with private, we need to get out of that business. So we did. It's about a $2 million savings that's reflected in our budget this time around as a result of that reorganization. We did not drop all of the operational services that we have provided in the past. We're going to continue that as we transition out through this next biennium so that the agencies that have been dependent upon some of our services can gradually transition out without having any kind of break in service. And what we're going to get as a result of a consolidated effort with by reorganizing the Information Resource Management Division is that we created the Enterprise Information Strategy and Policy Division. And we're looking at IT on a more enterprise base, allowing the agencies to have the flexibility that they need to operate within their own disciplines, utilizing their own technical staff, and we start looking from a central administrative standpoint what is going to be better for the broader sense of state government in IT-related business. Example, electronic government, e-government. How do we create an environment where we can allow a person to access a state agency for some type of a permit, and along with that query, that person, when they contact an agency, also gets a list of the other agencies that they need to contact for information, permits, etc. In fact, even routing them into a county or city level so that they know immediately from their desk what it is they have to do in order to conduct their business. Those are the kinds of things that I think an enterprise base will provide for the citizens of this state.
Madam Chair, are we allowed to say hallelujah?
Yes, please.
Jim Johnson, Senator George, give me a few more years, though. Because it is going to take some time of planning to work that out. But that is where we need to be.
I was just demonstrating that I could always get you to blush.
Okay.
Please move ahead, Mr. Ball.
Also, we look at the Enterprise Security Office from an enterprise base, providing security across the state network. Business continuity planning, where we plan and deliver services in a disaster situation, such as a tornado or hurricane, tsunami, earthquake, wild catastrophic fire of some sort. Geospatial information systems. I think this is one that we're just now starting to turn the page on. We have a lot of geospatial information at the county, city, and federal level, and the state level, but we are not sharing that information consistently across all lines. There are little capsules of information that aren't shared. We currently have a policy option package in the DAS budget to bring those different information entities into one place where we can share it. And let me give you a couple of examples as to how it has saved the state, or saved the public, absolutely millions of dollars. In the last couple of years, there was a serious wildland fire in Wasco County. There was one in Deschutes County. That is the information of personal property and dwellings out in the rural areas were identified well ahead of time, those properties in the path of that fire. Fire suppression crews were there ahead of it. They did not lose property. We saved absolutely millions of dollars for some people in those respective counties just by simply having that information available at that level, getting those fire suppression crews there ahead of time without losing the buildings. IT investment and planning. What is going to be the best for the state of Oregon with respect to IT planning in the future? Allowing us to focus on that from an enterprise base, I think, will prove advantageous to us in the state of Oregon.
Mr. Ball, perhaps you would comment on that a little bit with respect to how that planning and investment is going to be. It sounds as though you're centralizing it here in DAS so that agencies wouldn't be taking off on information technology adventures without having some certain protocols in place. And I don't know whether I'm reading too much into your answer, or you could inform us a little bit about just with the money involved in some of these huge IT projects and spotty levels of expertise across agencies, how is it that you can assure prudent investment and good deliverables?
Chair Johnson, we currently have a good example of that very same situation that you're referring to. The state has a need to overhaul its human resource information system. In conjunction with that, although we were not ready to step forward with a full-blown plan at this time on an enterprise base, the Oregon Department of Transportation was taking a look at their internal system, and they saw the need to upgrade their human resource information system. They wanted to move ahead. I certainly didn't want to hold them back. That's typically not my nature to try to hold anything back. If it's a good idea, let's get after it. And the Department of Transportation definitely was on the right track. They came and sat down with us, told us what they wanted to do. We set up some guidelines as to what we could live with. And it comes down to a point where we entered into an agreement that they would move forward, blaze the trail, so to speak, for a broader enterprise basis for our human resource information system that we have set up in a planning stage at this time in state government. That way, Chair Johnson, we're making the most of our investment, and we're being efficient by a little bit of a trial and error ahead of a full-blown enterprise-based program and implementation. One example.
Thank you.
I'd like to give you a brief overview of some of the detailed major IT projects that we have that we're currently working. I think, as Chair Johnson mentioned, many of you are familiar with the Scenic Project, or what we're now referring to as the State Data Center, since the project is winding its way down to full implementation. That project was fraught with difficulties. There's no question about it. When I came to the Department of Administrative Services January 3rd of 2006, just a year ago, I had questions about the project itself, or myself. I asked several other people about the project as well. Met with the governing board, which is made up of the 12 agency directors, the 12 agencies that were going to move into the data center. We refocused the direction that the governing board had been taking and tuned up the planning processes, the staffing levels, the financial business model that was behind it. Lessons learned, just to be brief, number one, make sure that your planning is well placed and can be easily followed. Number two, you have to put somebody in charge. And I'm not saying a body is the responsible entity. You have to have an individual that you go to. That's what makes projects work. Who's accountable, who's responsible. And lastly, don't go through all the legislation and then hire the program manager, the expert. Hire the expert up front. and then walk through the planning processes with the expert hand in hand. Don't do that again. just my observations of what we saw with the scenic project. Second to that, though, let me explain what we did and why I feel comfortable with the project today. Starting in January, refocusing the governing board of the scenic project, we revised the staffing levels associated with the data center. We also took a look at the financial backbone of that investment, altered it to where it would fit and work. We came before the GLCIMT committee in March, gave them an overview of what we proposed to do with the planning and implementation. We then came to a general government subcommittee in the emergency board in April of 2006, explained to them what we wanted to accomplish and why. We were given permission to move forward with the amended planning and implementation. That also allowed us to make sure that we conveyed to the GLCIMT and the e-board on a monthly basis the progress of the scenic project. To date, all agencies, with the exception of education, are in the data center. We're receiving good service out of that consolidation. Education, let me explain why education is not there yet. There's some question and challenge as to whether or not the federal government or federal law will allow education data to be housed in a non-education entity such as the data center. We from the state's level feel that we can work through this. We're working with Department of Justice and counsel from the federal government and Ed Dennis from the Department of Ed to see if we can get this straightened out. We should have an answer sometime, I would say mid-February, early March, as to their status, and hopefully we can move forward at that time.
Mr. Ball, one of the things that I think some of us are looking for reassurance, and I hope I'm not just speaking for myself, but many of us sat in the same room and heard representations from the former director of DAS and the certified smart guys that she had hired promising us that Scenic would be implemented seamlessly, that there were no problems, that the requisite planning had been done ahead of time. It sounds as though, absent your leadership, that we would have had another near-death experience, and I think for some of us, the memory of what happened with DMV is still pretty fresh. What I'm trying to figure out is where within state government, maybe you're not prepared to answer this, but where within state government do we begin to compile all these lessons learned so that we're not hanging out $100 million on information technology projects and we find out that some essential piece of information is missing? In this case, hiring the project manager ahead of time. I guess the other question, and I'll wait for your answer when we do the hearings at the subcommittee level, but it seems kind of odd that there would be a projection that education would be included without ascertaining ahead of time that there might be some federal bar to keeping that information in a consolidated location. But the real question that I'm posing to you is, how can we assure the citizens of the state of Oregon that government is sort of getting it with respect to these huge IT projects and that we're not going to launch on adventures where the planning hasn't been laid down properly at the beginning end?
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, I've labored over that question myself, and a couple of things I can give you the textbook answer.
Give me the honest answer.
Yeah, let me give you the textbook answer first, so you can wrap the textbook into the honest answer. Textbook answer is follow appropriate project protocols. There's a system of protocols, steps that you have to follow when you're implementing a project. And one of those, and many of those steps involves the understanding of what is taking place. Now, and looking back on the scenic project, I think there was a question in a lot of people's minds about the project planning phase. and how that just kept rolling along without someone stalking it to get the answers that they wanted, I don't know. I can't answer that. But I think my textbook answer is follow the appropriate protocols on project management. And lastly, I think we're all going to have to place faith in people that are highly skilled to conduct these types of projects in the state. And I'm not trying to slight anyone from the past, but I do want to point out the turnover in the Department of Administrative Services, and both in the director's position and in the chief information officer position, left a void and was filled with, as I've heard someone say, well, the last dead guy did that. It wasn't me. And I think continuity would help heal a lot of that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that another piece of this that did get quite a bit of discussion in the last session is something that would be well served to continue to introduce into this process that we're in right now, and that is that we don't have anybody in the legislative fiscal arena that really understands computer systems and has the expertise in that area to advise us. And we're all kind of amateurs coming into that arena. Some of us have more expertise than others, but these are extremely dynamic, complex systems that deal in technologies that are highly specialized. And I think that to add someone to our fiscal team that has expertise in that area and that can advise us is something that would be a reasonable thing to consider in the legislative budget arena.
I think that's a great idea. Mr. Ball, do you have any concluding remarks?
Well, there have been a lot of changes in the IT world in the Department of Administrative Services this last year, challenges and changes, and there will be more. And if anyone has any questions about what I'm doing or the staff in the department is doing, don't hesitate to call. The best way to sort out issues is to create the communication link, and I'm available. And I've always said I learn more from legislators, and legislators never learn from me. So if you give me some information, it's very valuable to me.
With that invitation to stay connected up to the Department of Administrative Services, I am going to conclude this informational hearing and declare us adjourned without objection.
Thank you.